in order to do that, you have to work with the questions in that regard was something like, well, why didn't he work with people instead of monkeys? But I thought that was very interesting. And then the second half of what he said was about something which left me well in the dust of and sort of got on a roll which made it very difficult for me to understand. I'm not being critical of Nick here. I'm fully accepting that this is quite likely my failing. But I thought the first half of what Nick said was very interesting. The second half left me pretty breathless. So I thought what was interesting about what Nick said in the first half yesterday was that I could have said exactly the same thing. I was interested in what made people tick. It seemed like we were going down exactly the same track, and then he veered off to say, well, let's talk about monkeys, and I veered off to say, well, let's ask people directly, because I wanted Nick to be saying, well, why don't we ask the monkey what's going on with her? And the lines, I think, well, of course, the monkey can't do that. And so then, for me, it would be like, well, why did you choose to use monkeys as opposed to people? And that... So one thing that occurred to me was that Nick and I should have a public conversation about this. Well, why is it that he does it that he did it that way in his career and I did it this way in my career? One of us either made a very big mistake or there's two quite distinct tracks to be had here. I don't know which one of those is right. I think I'm okay with determining today or at the course of this weekend that my career has been a total mistake. I've been okay with that. I think pretty much most of my career actually has been. So in the context of this sort of meditation at about 3 o'clock in the morning, it occurred to me that maybe what we should do is to sort of integrate together everything that we talked about yesterday in the following way. And so this is a proposal to Nick that I didn't make to Nick, so this is unfair to Nick because I've been thinking about it and haven't given him a chance. So it's a sort of a group process here. But maybe what we should do is for Nick to give this spiel that he's about to give sort of aimed directly at me, because he's about to talk about things which I find difficult to understand.
Well, unless I'm not, actually, because I'm not going to talk about that stuff as such. But, it sounds to me as I should have been doing the other talk I prepared. I'm interested in everything you say, and I think, well, there's several things going on. One, I'm sure I wasn't as coherent as I should have been last night because there's been a bit of jet lag and things. But the talk I'm about to give, it doesn't directly address any of these issues, no monkeys or anything else. It's more an exercise in what a particular use of first person phenomenology and trying to relate it to some evolutionary issues. I think I'd love to have this conversation with you, but you won't find this talk make sense as addressed to you on those issues.
That may be, and if you would prefer for me to just shut the fuck up and let you give your talk, that's fine with me too. But the general issue, I think, which maybe divides some of us from some of the rest of us, has to do with whether first person research is about asking somebody to report what their first person experience is about, or whether first person research is sort of the meta conversation about that, what the ramifications, what the possibilities are. And that might be sort of a major divide that we haven't really talked much about here.
My take on it is that our first person experience of consciousness is the crucial fact in the world. That's what consciousness does. It gives us a first person take on something remarkable. My scientific question is, why is it there and what effects is it having? And so I'm interested in every level of first person experience, from reports to blushes to swoons or whatever it might be, anything which changes somebody arising from their experience of consciousness interests me as a scientist, because it's those public aspects on which natural selection has acted in designing consciousness. Consciousness hasn't arisen out of nothing. It's been given to us through a process, long process of natural selection. The only thing that nature has been able to see is the results on individuals of the meditations and the reveries and the, you know, the immediate responses to what they discover in consciousness. So that's the first person experience is either just innocent and naive and so on. I mean, everybody every day every moment of the day is demonstrating their consciousness in some ways. There are also more reflective ways of doing it, which are deeply interesting because people have been reflecting on consciousness, I think, since time began. And those reflections have changed who they are and have changed their relationships with each other. And those are all part of the data. But I don't think there are two parts here. I'm interested in investigating consciousness, first-person consciousness, because I think it matters. You're more interested in just doing it. I mean, but to see what you discover there, but it's what you discover there which I think matters. So, and it changes it. The fact we're all meeting here today is one of the consequences of the phenomenon of consciousness. And consciousness is mind-blowing. And the question is why? And what's it done? Why have we been graced with this astonishing phenomenon? Only because it changes us in ways. So it's true that, you know, reports are one rather straightforward way, and in many ways often the only way we have of distilling what someone's discovering, but actually the reports don't do justice to the phenomenon, and many other behaviour and moods and relationships get changed by things which they can't articulate, but which are less a part of the consequences of being conscious. So I don't think reports are the only thing, it's just that there's a, I mean, they're easy to communicate. But to come to my talk, I think I should get on with it, but it's not, see what I thought I'd do, I actually spent the last 3 weeks, Susan knows, I was in doing what I call philosophy in Ireland. I borrowed the term philosophy from Daniel Dennett, who does philosophy on his tractor. And I did prepare another talk, it's there, it's called New Lecture. but then I thought, well, actually, it'll go emerge. What I want to say that I think will emerge as the discussion goes on. I mean, we're beginning to talk about it right now. But if I did that, since we have limited time for presentations, I wouldn't get to give you this more polished, but I think interesting example of where we can get my particular take on thinking about consciousness. The talk I want to give is a talk which was for the Royal Society meeting last year on social intelligence. And I had to speak last. It was a meeting which was partly to celebrate the 30th anniversary of a paper I wrote called The Social Function of Intellect. And at the end of it, I thought, well, I can't just repeat myself. And anyway, everyone else knows much more about this than I do 30 years later. So what I thought I'd do is to kind of pull away and say something different from what I said 30 years ago. So this is a talk about the loneliness of the human condition. In a way, as you'll see, I'm saying it's consciousness which basically guarantees our loneliness, and therefore one of the central, most significant facts about consciousness might be the fact where it separates us from other people. I also thought it would interest you because I know it will fly straight against what many of you think, because people, you know, talk intersubjectivity is of course the thing which people think of first sometimes when they think of consciousness. I want to say that maybe we shouldn't, that there are other aspects of consciousness. So what should I do? Should I give the talk?
Yes.
Okay. It's called The Society of Souls. It might have been called, I thought, Every Man is an Island Entire to Himself.
John was on the carrier.
Yes. this works.
It's coming.
Now, how much of this is going to fit on the screen? I think it will. Let's just see.
Is it okay?
It's stuck.
F5 went through a brain.
Huh?
F5.
Yeah. F5. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to half read this, because it's kind of convenient to hang together. This word, Ujamaa, it's a Swahili word, and it has no simple translation into English. But its meaning is made clear in the Ujamaa carvings created by the Makonde craftsmen of Tanzania. In these carvings, often called trees of life, human figures of all sorts and ages are intertwined in a rising column of ebony. Everyone's busy doing their own thing. One cooks, another hammers, a third sews, a fourth nurses her baby. The figures tumble up against each other so closely that their spaces and their forms are defined by the bodies of their neighbours. Yet, all the same, all the time, they retain their separate identities and personalities. Ujamaa, it's clear, refers to nothing less than the human capacity for the capacity of human beings, despite their differences, to work together as a community, something that humans are better able to do than any other animal on Earth. Well, what gives humans this unparalleled capacity to get along together? What special talent do they have for doing what I've called natural psychology? And the answer that I and many others have converged on is that there's evolved in the human line, and maybe just within the human line in the last few million years, a talent and a desire for deep intersubjectivity, a special capacity for mind reading, underpinned by empathy, the sharing of feelings, and sympathy, the sharing of goals. That's the message that's been emerging from the flurry of research and writing on theory of mind and the uniquely human social brain. Humans alone know what it's like to be in someone else's place, and humans alone care. That's the message I began to spell out in my 1976 paper on the social function of intellect. I developed it later in books such as Consciousness Regained and The Inner Eye. Well, I'm not going to tell you this morning that I've changed my mind. However, on reflection, I do want to pull back a bit, or at any rate to pull in another direction. I'm going to argue in the next half hour that in stressing shared consciousness and intersubjectivity, we may be missing something crucial. There's no great truth, it's been said, which the opposite is not also a great truth. And I want to suggest that when it comes to it, human beings are not only exceptionally sociable, they are also exceptionally lonely. And loneliness may play a key part in shaping human life and human culture. But I'm not going to start with this, because I've got a debt left over from 1976 that I want to settle first. In the 1880s, long before I or anyone else in evolutionary psychology came on the scene, the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche was already speculating about the very same issues that have now become the cutting edge of modern science, about the evolution of consciousness and its relation to social life. I'm ashamed to say that I hadn't read Nietzsche when I wrote my first paper on social intelligence, all the papers that followed about theory of mind and consciousness. More shameful still, I confess that as an experimental psychologist educated at Cambridge, it never occurred to me that I ought to have read Nietzsche. So it wasn't until much too late that I found out how closely Nietzsche's arguments anticipated mine. And I suspect that what was news to me may still be news to you, even to members of this group. Here's what Nietzsche wrote in The Gay Science. The problem of consciousness confronts us only when we begin to comprehend how we could dispense with it. For we could think, feel, will, and remember, and we could act in every sense of that word, and yet none of all of this would have to enter consciousness. The whole of life would be possible without, as it were, seeing itself in a mirror. For what purpose, then, any consciousness at all, when it's in the main superfluous? I may now proceed to the surmise that consciousness is really only a net of communication between human beings. A solitary human being who lived like a beast of prey would not have needed it. That our thoughts, actions, feelings, and movements enter our own consciousness, at least a part of them, that is the result of a must that for a terribly long time lorded it over man. As the most endangered animal, he needed help and protection. He needed his peers. He had to learn to express his distress and to make himself understood. And for all of this, he needed consciousness first of all. He needed to know himself, what distressed him. He needed to know how he felt. He needed to know what he thought. My idea, as you see, is that consciousness does not really belong to man's individual existence, but rather to his herd or social or herd nature. Well, Nietzsche not only highlighted this role for consciousness, he also had a proposal for precisely how this net of communication is created. Here's what he wrote in Daybreak. Empathy, to understand another person, that is to imitate his feelings in ourselves. We produce the feeling in ourselves after the effects it exerts and displays on the other person, by imitating with our own body the expression of his eyes, his voice, his walk, his bearing. Then a similar feeling arises in us, in consequence of an ancient association between movement and sensation. We've brought our skill in understanding the feeling of others to a high state of perfection, and in the presence of another person, we're almost always involuntarily practicing this skill. So Nietzsche, in short, was ahead of me, and perhaps ahead of you too, in all these ways. First, he formulated the social intelligence hypothesis, realizing that human beings have to be natural psychologists in order to survive. Second, he saw how this would have led to the evolution of a capacity for reflexive consciousness as the basis for a theory of mind. And third, he recognized how empathy arises from simulation mediated by imitation of action and expression. Now, these ideas have come into their own at last. They're being developed at the frontiers of ethology, psychology, and neuroscience. And I'm sure I've no need to remind you of the buzz that now surrounds them. Of course, the one thing that Nietzsche didn't anticipate, and now I may say did I, was the existence of mirror neurons. Do people here know about mirror neurons? Basically, for anyone who doesn't, I just put and added another slide here. The discovery by... Rizzolatti and Galesi in Italy, of neurons in a monkey's brain, in this case, they have now been discovered also in humans as well, or something very like them, which seem to be able to imitate someone else's action. You find in the prefrontal motor cortex single nerve cells which respond not only when the monkey makes a movement, such as number one there to pick up a nut, you can see the spikes underneath it, but also the very same nerve cell responding when it sees, in this case, a human being picking up a nut with the same gesture. These are remarkably selective, that neurons which some people call them monkey see, monkey do neurons, neurons which seem to translate between an observed action and an action performed by the self. And the discovery of these neurons has given a huge fillip to this field of understanding, trying to understand empathy. Ramachandran in San Diego has said, I predict that mirror neurons will do for psychology what DNA did for biology. And in a recent article, Galesi and his colleagues, they build mirror neurons as providing a unifying view of the basis of social cognition. A headline in the New York Times recently called these neurons cells that read minds. And in the article that follows, Mark Jacoponi is quoted as saying, claiming, you automatically have empathy for me. You know how I feel because you literally feel what I am feeling. Indeed, neuroscience itself is beginning to be wonderfully in touch. In 2005, as many of you must know, the Dalai Lama was cheered to the rooftops at the Society for Neuroscience in Washington when he explained the relevance of Buddhist ideas about the connectedness of everything. Typical of this new trend, I was invited to a conference last year in Bologna, something a bit like this one, by a group called ASIA, the point being to address primordial questions about consciousness. And centered on the question, do you have a pragmatic proposal to make first-person experience intersubjectively shareable? It seems that ideas about flow and connectedness are fast becoming not just politically, but scientifically correct. If I don't feel your pain, or at any rate have a pragmatic proposal for feeling it, then I'd better not let on. Now, don't get me wrong, I'd be the first to agree that the field of consciousness studies has entered an exceptionally exciting phase. Yet, with the social brain and mirror neurons all the rage, I do think there's a danger that in the rush to emphasize empathy as a human birthright, we may be failing to recognize, perhaps even willfully failing to recognize, the extent to which consciousness creates barriers between people, even as it unites them. In both my early books, I used paintings by Paul Gauguin to illustrate what it means for us to look into and read another person's mind. Gauguin, writing of his 13-year-old wife, had said, "I strive to see and think through this child," and the stated aim of many of his paintings was to understand the mystery of things and people by going inside them to reveal the deep structures that make them what they are. Likewise, I suggested, ordinary human beings are continually doing something like this in daily social life. We all, every day of our lives, imagine more than we can see, and we do it most impressively and most importantly when, almost without noticing it, we make imaginative guesses about the hidden contents of the human mind. We have only so much as to glance at another human being, and once he begins to read beneath the surface, we see there another conscious person like ourselves. We see someone with human feelings, memories, desires, a mind potentially like ours. But I should have looked more closely, more carefully, for I now think that my choice of Gauguin to illustrate the case of mind reading was a perverse one. Gauguin as a painter was indeed a genius at going behind appearances to reveal hidden meanings, but what he revealed about human society is actually very far from that legendary net of communication between human beings. Within the year of arriving in Tahiti in 1891, Gauguin had made a carving with an uncanny resemblance to a Makonde tree of life. It seems probable that he had in fact seen the Makonde carving when he visited the colonial exhibition in Paris in 1889, where many works of African art were on display. In Gauguin's carving, as in the Makonde model, the figures line up next to each other, sharing the same bit of wood. However, that's where the resemblance ends, for Gauguin has done nothing to convey the spirit of Ujamaa. The figures in his carving, rather than communicating, are more like strap hangers in a crowded subway train, physically close, but mentally cut off. The absence of human communion, is in fact one of the most striking features of Gauguin's representations of people in his Tahitian paintings. In the paintings, individuals never touch, nor hardly even look at each other. In stark contrast with the Tree of Life, each occupies his or her own mental world, private and separate. What Gauguin seems to want to stress is the psychological distance between people, the extent to which everyone remains an enigma to everyone else. Indeed, as if to underscore this, he gives titles to the paintings in the form of uncomprehending questions about what's going on. Why are you angry? What? Are you jealous? When will you marry? These paintings, I would now say, are about the otherness of other people. This phrase, the otherness of other people, is one I've taken from the novelist John Banville, who in his recent novel, The Sea, used it. He's speaking of the girl he was obsessed with. The narrator writes, "In her, Chloe, I had my first experience of the absolute otherness of other people. It's not too much to say, well it is, but I'll say it anyway, that in Chloe, the world was first manifest for me as an objective entity. I never knew where I was with her or what sort of treatment to expect at her hands." Well, let's note it's important that Chloe in this novel is no stranger to the narrator. No more than the people in Gauguin's paintings are strangers to each other. In fact, it seems to be part of the point being made by both novelist and painter that it's precisely when people get closest to others and have come to know them well as familiar, objective entities, that the psychological otherness becomes most obvious and most alarming. Sexual intimacy, in particular, can provide a worrying test. As Gauguin revealed in his letters and diaries, sex was never far from his thoughts. While rooming with Van Gogh in their yellow house in Arles, he made provision in their joint budget for regular outings to prostitutes for what he called hygienic excursions to satisfy his insistent manhood. He did it seems, primarily for health reasons, and perhaps this was just as much true after he moved to Tahiti. Gauguin made only one picture of the act of sex, but it's a revealing one. The woman looks up and away, her mind quite clearly somewhere else. In several paintings of his young wife in Tahiti, he shows her lying on her bed, post-coitus, the very picture of solitariness. Now, possibly Gauguin was unusually cavalier in his attitude towards making love. Even so, the fact is that for all too many couples, sexual intercourse is actually a lesson in mental separateness. Carnal knowledge, a lesson in spiritual agnosia. John Dryden, more than 300 years ago, in a translation of a poem by Lucretius, spelt out the stark reality. They gripe, they squeeze, their humid tongues they dart, as each would force their way to each other's heart. In vain they only cruise about the coast, for bodies cannot pierce, nor be in bodies lost. Always they try, successes all they prove, to cure the secret sore of lingering love. The poet W.B. Yeats called these lines the finest description of sexual intercourse ever written, precisely because they illustrate just how impossible it is for two to become a unity. The tragedy of sexual intercourse, Yeats said, is the perpetual virginity of the soul. I will see why I'm thinking now into first-person ethics. That's what you say when you've been there. By the end of 1897, Gauguin had had enough. His hopes of discovering the essence of being human, through love, through friendship, through history, seemed to have come to nothing. He was disillusioned and depressed, and he wanted to die. Still, in a last effort to make a grand statement of his ethical discoveries, he completed in a fever of work the biggest of all his paintings, and he wrote on it, he said it was his signature, D'où venons-nous, quoi sommes-nous, où allons-nous? Then, on New Year's Eve, he climbed the hill behind his house with a box of arsenic in his pocket, intent on killing himself. In the event, he took too much of the poison and vomited it up, and after lying out a few hours, he dragged himself disconsolately back home. Gauguin's attempt at suicide failed, but his attempt at revealing in this last picture something profound about what it's like to be human certainly succeeded. There have been a thousand interpretations of this painting, but I've no hesitation in telling you my own. What the puzzled, isolated figures of the painting speak to is the essential loneliness of the human condition. Que sommes-nous? What are we? The bottom line is that we are not a we. We are a set of I's. Individuals who, because of the very nature of conscious selfhood, are in principle unable to get through to one another and to share the most central facts of our psychical existence. Nietzsche was wrong. When it comes to consciousness, we are on our own. Soul and solo. Etymologically, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, there's no connection between soul as a noun and soul as a predicate, though I may say I wonder. But psychologically and even logically, the connection is all too clear. There are no doors between one consciousness and another. Everyone knows directly only of his or her own consciousness and no one else's. It's also horribly obvious when you think about it, and we do think about it. Since we were children, we've all played with the riddles of otherness that flow from the essential inaccessibility of other minds. To take John Locke's famous example of seeing colours, how do I know that my colour sensation when I see a violet is not like yours when you see a marigold? The answer, which has never taken a great philosopher to prove to us, is simply that I don't. Because, as Locke said, one man's mind cannot pass into another man's body. Of course, probably, we long ago ceased to find this conclusion novel, yet there's no denying how strange and upsetting it was, and is, at first discovery. Not simply an interesting tease, but a gaping hole at the centre of our need for communion. If I cannot even tell what seeing red is like for you, what can I tell? Imagine, we're walking together in the woods after the rain. Dappled sunshine filters through the dripping leaves. A blackbird sings. The scent of honeysuckle permeates the rich air. It may be that shared moments like this are needed to give meaning to our lives, shared moments of consciousness. What then if we should realize how little we are truly sharing? That if truth be told, each of us is merely colouring in the other's consciousness as if it was his or her own. I suggest that what Gauguin was showing in that last great painting is just how hard it is to come to terms with this result. To have to face the fact of being oneself, this self, another, none other, the secret packet of phenomena, the singular bubble of consciousness. Press up against each other as we may, and the bubbles remain essentially inviolate. Share the same body even, be joined like Siamese twins, and there still remain two quite separate consciousnesses. Perhaps the tragedy of being human is the perpetual virginity of the soul. But how funny was it? I mean, funny and peculiar. Nothing else in the world is private in quite the same way, the same disturbing way that conscious experience is. Everything else in the world joins up in the four-dimensional space-time manifold that basic physics says is sufficient to describe the whole universe. But consciousness, it seems, is essentially different. Indeed, each individual's consciousness would seem to be as much a world apart on its own plane of existence as is each separate universe in the multiverse that cosmologists sometimes fantasize about. Let alone the open doors between one conscious self and another, it seems there's not even the possibility of tunneling through a wormhole. It's hardly surprising that many ordinary people find this situation puzzling, even paradoxical. Puzzlement isn't because they're missing something. It's not because they're making a category error or because they don't know how to talk properly, although some philosophers persist in saying so. Consciousness really is deeply, fascinatingly, peculiarly private. And the meaning and the explanation of this privacy continues to pose a major challenge to cognitive science and to philosophy of mind. Well, my own approach as a scientist has been to look for an explanation for the privacy of consciousness in its deep evolutionary history. That's to say, I've tried to explain how consciousness could have evolved little by little, always under natural selection, to be so constructed as to be private. In fact, I've argued that it's evolved to be private on two quite different levels. Consciousness has become necessarily private on the phenomenal level, meaning that one person cannot in principle have access to another's subjective awareness of what it's like to be conscious, to be sensing red, for example. But then consciousness has also become contingently private on the propositional level, meaning that one person usually does not even have access to the objective fact that another person is sensing red. That's to say, you can't know what it's like for me to be experiencing the red, but you can't even tell that I'm experiencing it when I look at the red screen. Well, this is not the place to go into this theory of consciousness in any great depth. It's part of what my more recent book, Seeing Red, is largely about. But if I may, I can move to a slightly more analytical kind of discussion for a moment, I'll try to summarize what I think the story is. And I'll begin with an analogy. When a person, let's say it's me, performs a bodily action, when I wiggle my right big toe, for example, there are two respects in which this action is something that uniquely belongs to me and or that I have a unique take on. First, it's I only who am doing it, wiggling this toe. I'm the author of the action, and of course no one else does or logically could stand in this first person subjective relation to the action of wiggling my toe. Thus the doing of it is necessarily private. I can't give away my action or share it, even if I want to. Now, true, you might perform a similar action with your body. You might perform it even at the very same time that I do. But still, you wouldn't be wiggling my toe, you'd be wiggling yours. But second, it's my body that's involved, the body to which I have a special spatio-temporal relationship. And so I can hardly miss the fact that the wiggle is occurring in my foot, my toe. Now, true, I'm not the only one who could, in principle, make this observation as an objective fact. If I'm acting in public, say, I mean, if it's logically possible, you too could observe that I'm wiggling my toe. seemingly wicked writer. But suppose I perform the action covertly behind this podium, say, or in my boot, then everyone else except for me will be out of the observational loop. You don't know if I'm a wicked writer now or not. Thus, many of the observations I'm able to make about my actions will be contingently private. I could, in principle, share the objective information with you, but in many cases I won't have to, and in fact I won't choose to. Now, how does that tie in with consciousness? What could my unique take on my bodily actions have to do with my unique take on my conscious sensations? What can the private nature of wiggling my toe have to do with the private nature of seeing red, or smelling a rose, or feeling pain? Well, according to the theory I've developed, it can have everything to do with it, because sensations actually are a kind of bodily action, or at any rate, they were. Sensations are not things that happen to us. They are indeed things we do. When I look at a red screen, for example, I respond to what's happening at my eyes with a pattern of bodily activity, a pattern that originated far back in evolutionary history as an instinctive, evaluative response to the stimulus. In the old days, the very old days, I mean, we're talking hundreds of millions of years ago, such responses to the stimulus were indeed public behaviour, bodily expressions of liking or disgust, riddles of acceptance or rejection. I shouldn't have done modern human being, but imagine this thing going back to our amoeba-like ancestors. The responses would have been there for anyone to see. However, what happened in the course of evolution was that these responses became what I've called privatized. They began to get short-circuited before they reached the body's surface, so that the motor signals, instead of reaching all the way out to the site of stimulation, now reached only to points closer and closer in on the incoming sensory nerve, until eventually the whole process became closed off from the outside world. In fact, the efferent signals for making these movements, these expressions, now project only as far as the sensory cortex, where they interact with the incoming signals from the sense organs to create momentarily a self-entangling recursive loop. The upshot is that when looking at the screen, I'm still responding to the stimulation with something like the ancient action pattern handed down from my ancestors. The action still retains vestiges of its original evaluative function, its intentionality, and its hedonic tone. But now it's become a virtual action pattern, an as-if response directed to an as-if body hidden inside my head. So, now for me to be phenomenally conscious of having the sensation, for there to be something it's like to be doing this. There's nothing more or less than for me to be actively engaged in generating this response, as extended by the recursion into what I call the thick moment of conscious presence. Meanwhile, for me to have the propositional part of the experience, to observe that I'm having a red sensation, is simply for me to monitor the fact that I am so engaged. Whence then the privacy of consciousness? Well, think back to the analogy of my wiggling my toe. The theory is right, the necessary privacy of the phenomenal experience is guaranteed by the fact that the sensation is my doing. I'm doing this squiggle inside my head. When I generate sensations, I experience a subjective qualia from a perspective which, as a matter of principle, is not available to anyone else. This would be so even if the sensory responses hadn't been internalized. But they have been. So the contingent privacy of the propositional part of the experience is guaranteed by the fact that my sensory experience, my sensory responses are no longer public. Only I can observe that I am having a particular sensation, because only I can observe what I'm creating inside my head. The point isn't that you could not know that I could in any way that I'm doing it, merely that in most circumstances you simply will not know. Unless perhaps you can infer it from some external cue. If you do infer it, it could lead to your mirroring the sensory response in your own brain. But note that this will not give you access to my phenomenal experience. Through mirroring the sensory response, you may indeed learn that I am sensing red. You may sense red yourself, but it will be you sensing your red. So, Has anyone got a pragmatic proposal to make first-person experience intersubjectively shareable? You can see that in the light of this analysis, why I don't hold out much hope that any scientist or philosopher will ever be able to give Buddhists or others the answer they want. I feel your pain. No, when you're in pain, I may or may not recognize that you're feeling pain. I may indeed feel my own mirror version of the pain, but your pain, remains strictly inalienable. Consider again the case of Siamese twins. It's a matter of record. I mean, the twins will tell anyone who asks that their conscious minds are as private as the next person's. Does one conjoined twin know what it's like for the other twin to have a headache? No, or yes, or maybe, or can't be sure, no more than you or I do. Oftentimes, one twin will not even know that the other has a headache. I confess, despite all my theorizing, I still find that fact astonishing. So let me return to society and to trees of life. The fact is, ordinary people have never needed any of this analysis to know this score. They've had a lifetime to check it out firsthand through their own first-person experiments and exercises. How was it for you? I presume the honest answer will always have been virginal, because there's simply no other way for it to be. Yet, if the virginity of the soul is the reality, is it necessarily such a tragedy? I'd say there are evolutionary grounds for thinking that it cannot be too much of a tragedy. For if it were, then natural selection would never have allowed things to develop in this way, in the way they have done. To the contrary, the fact that natural selection has allowed it, even arranged for it, would suggest that the inaccessibility of consciousness may even be, in some respects, positively advantageous. However, in that case, there would be two quite separate questions to address. One, the advantage of the contingent privacy of propositional consciousness. The other, the advantage of the absolute privacy of phenomenal consciousness. And the first is much easier to deal with than the second. As to the first, I expect many of you will already have run ahead of me. It must be obvious enough to anyone who knows anything about sociobiology why a social animal, such as a human being, would be better off if it were to have at least the possibility of keeping the existence of its thoughts and feelings to itself. The capacity for mind reading and for being mind read is all very well, but human individuals, even in the closest knit cooperative groups, are still usually to some degree in competition. So there must certainly be times when individuals do not want to be a completely open book to others. Paul Valéry, the poet, made the point as succinctly as anyone might want. Credit, he wrote, requires that the walls of coffers be opaque, and the interchange of human things between men requires that brains be impenetrable. The advantages of tactical deception are obvious even in apes and crows. If consciousness does provide a net of communication, nonetheless, there's clearly much to be said for facultative privacy, for having the option of being able to log out and go offline. But now for the second question, about the absolute privacy of consciousness, of phenomenal consciousness. Could there be anything to be said for consciousness being so structured that individuals cannot share aspects of their experience even if they want to? Well, let me explain just what it is I'm asking now, because I expect many of you will think that in this case the answer must be no. Couldn't be any advantage in not being able to share, even in principle. Could the fact, for example, that I must forever be sure, unsure, what I experience as a sensation of red is the same as what you experience, could that conceivably change my life in a positive way? Could it make any difference at all? Well, it's worth noting what John Locke had to say. In his passage in the essay where he sets up the thought experiment about one man's marigold being another man's violet, this passage is quite well known. Here it is. Suppose he wrote, the idea that a violet produced in one man's mind by his eyes were the same that a yellow marigold produced in another man's and vice versa. This could never be known because one man's mind could not pass into another man's body to perceive what appearances were produced. That's well known and often quoted, but the passage that immediately follows this is hardly known at all, and not quoted by real philosophers, who should know better than I do about what Locke wrote. What he goes on to do is to deny that colour inversion is a possibility worth taking seriously. I am nevertheless very apt to think that the sensible ideas produced by any object in different men's minds are most commonly indiscernibly alike, for which opinion there might be many reasons offered, but being besides my present business, I shall not trouble my reader with them, but only remind him that the contrary supposition, if it could be proved, is of little use either for the improvement of our knowledge or the convenience of life. Notice perhaps shades of the mathematician Fermat here, who wrote in the margin of his notebook that I have a truly marvellous proof of this proposition, which this margin is too narrow to contain. Well, Locke's not going to tell us what his answer is. But I think the fact is that Locke actually has simply lost his philosophical nerve, and he's wrong to have done so. For in truth, neither he nor anyone else has ever been able to offer the reasons he alludes to why colour sensations have to be alike. Even Ludwig Wittgenstein would later concede in the Philosophical Investigations that the essential thing about private experience is really not that each person possesses his own exemplar, but that nobody knows whether other people have this or something else. The assumption would thus be possible, though unverifiable, that one section of mankind has one sensation of red and another section another.
I think that quote from Wittgenstein is really it's very risky to quote it like that out of the context of the rest of the argument in the investigations.
It's
a tough one for most people trying to interpret his private language argument, because it seems to go absolutely against most of the other things he says.
I agree. But nonetheless, he's saying something I think is actually essentially true. I think the behaviour of Wittgenstein is less interesting than when he's actually talking about some of the first and formal terms that he sometimes says. But anyway, it's essential to my present business that I think Locke was wrong on another score as well, namely in saying that actually it's of little consequence, of little use to the convenience of life, this could be true, that we don't know what's going on in someone else's mind. To the contrary, I believe the realization that other people may possibly experience the world differently is potentially life-transforming. Now, how can that be? It's true, of course, that differences between people, that a difference between people, that is, as Wittgenstein says, unverifiable, that has to be a difference that makes no difference, if it's unverifiable. Yet this does not mean that the possibility of such a difference can make no difference. For why shouldn't it be that what makes the difference is precisely what someone makes of this possibility, the possibility that it makes no difference. Let me try and explain that. Consider the following analogy. Imagine two individuals, let's call them A and B, who each has a private box with a clock in it, which you can use to tell the time. Their clocks are identical, except for one peculiar feature. Namely, that while the hands on A's clock turn in a clockwise way, the hands on B's clock turn in an anti-clockwise way. When A and B read their clocks, they agree about what time it is, about the rate time is passing, and so on. So it would seem that the direction of rotation is just such a difference that makes no difference. But wait for it. Suppose A were to think, I wonder what it's like to be B, watching his clock, only to realise that he has no way of knowing whether B's clock rotates like his own or in the opposite direction. That's weird. A B could be clockwise like me or anti-clockwise, and I wouldn't know. Now, suppose A were to find this situation challenging. Suppose A were to be upset that he doesn't know about B, or perhaps pleased as punch that B doesn't know about him. Then here we would have a difference that makes no difference, but which makes a difference precisely because A realizes it makes no difference. My point is that this is very much how it is with sensations. Conscious human beings find themselves landed in a situation where the realization that they cannot know what phenomenal consciousness is like for other people may itself have a significant impact on what they think and what they do. The absolute privacy of consciousness may strike them as provocative, tantalizing, alarming, awe-inspiring, all of the above. One way or another, it will matter to them. And so, in large or small ways, it may change their attitude to other people, to themselves, and to the world. Now, I'd suggest there are two possible human responses to this situation that are of potential interest to an evolutionary psychologist like me. One is that people find it unacceptable, something to be denied or resisted. The other is that they find it wonderful, something to be celebrated. Well, so far I've stressed only how unhappy it may make people to realize how solitary they are, how solitary the soul is. Gauguin tried to kill himself. The poet John Clare sadly complaining, "I am, but what I am, none knows, nor cares." He went quietly mad. Others finding the whole thing too bewildering or too depressing to think about, push it aside or pretend they don't care. Clearly, no advantage comes from such responses. But there's another way of dealing with the problem, and that is to fight it, to struggle to get through to each other all the same. I said there are no wormholes between conscious minds, and really there are not. But this doesn't stop people avidly searching for them. Indeed, the attempt to defeat the reality and to find just such holes or even open doors underlies many of the most heroic efforts of human culture. Religious beliefs and practices pointedly stress spiritual communion, especially in a life to come. Group rituals and entertainments bring people together in the here and now, dancing together, singing together, worshipping together. As bodies move in synchrony, minds may indeed get as close as they ever can do to being united. Thanks to the existence of mirror neurons, it kind of works. Even if these communal activities bring people less close than they'd hope, even if kind of working is never quite enough, the quest will often prove beneficial, doing good things for social cohesion on other levels. But the second way of responding to the situation is just the opposite, and potentially of even greater evolutionary significance. Instead of either running away from the problem or trying to mend it, why not make the most of it? Just look what we've got here. If I myself have this astonishing phenomenon known only to me at the centre of my existence, and if, of course it's a big if, I can assume that you do too, then what does this say about the kind of people that we are? It's not just me. Each of us is a creative hub of consciousness. Each of us has a soul. No one has more than one. All men have been endowed by the Creator with an inalienable and inviolable mind space of their own. We are a society of selves. The idea that everyone is equally special in this way is extraordinarily potent psychologically, ethically, politically. And I dare say it would be and is highly adaptive. I believe it's likely to have risen within the human community as a direct response to reflecting on the remarkable properties of the conscious human mind. And from the beginning, it would have transformed human relationships, encouraging new levels of mutual respect and greatly increasing the value each person puts on their own and others' lives. In fact, I'd go so far as to suggest that it marked a watershed in the evolution of our species, the beginning of humanity's interest in the human project, a concern with humanity's past and humanity's future. Precisely the exercise of first-person access and thinking about what it means for oneself and what it must mean for other people. There's another Swahili word, Ubuntu, that complements Ujamaa. Desmond Tutu, the brave champion of human rights, gives this explanation. It's the idea that you cannot be human in isolation. You're human precisely because of relationships. You're a relational being, or you are nothing. But this is in no way contrary to what I've just been saying. Human beings need relationships. But the deepest and best relationships are going to be those between people who recognize the existence in others of a conscious self that is as strange and precious and private as their own. Well, can we say historically when this might have begun to come about? No, we can't yet. Archaeology and anthropology and evolutionary theory doesn't give us that information. But I think the archaeological record could still begin, has in fact begun to provide us with clues. In the village of Villafamish, in the Valencia region of Spain, there are some rock paintings in a cave just below the castle, dating to about 15,000 years ago. When I visited the cave January of last year, I was taken aback to see the resemblance between one of the images and a drawing I made some years ago about illustrating the privatization of sensation, one I've shown you. That's my photograph. I got my computer to enhance it for me. It's not going to do it. That is a direct mathematical enhancement of it, not just my take on it. And that is my illustration from the 1995 article about the privatization of sensation. Well, I wonder, was this rock painting an early Neolithic representation and celebration of what it means to have a self? And indeed, is this recurrent theme of spirals in early Neolithic art, and in fact around the world, something saying something the same? Here are three spirals of, no one knows what they mean, from a rock in Northumberland, in Great Britain. Are these people? Here's one from Australia. Are those people? Are these spirals talking about the inaccessibility and yet the importance and significance of each individual human being contained within his own mind? Well, I'll leave you with that speculation. I think that was my last slide there. Okay, that's my presentation. I hope you see how it addresses the interests of this conference. If you want, we'll take it from there.
No wormholes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I start with you from a basic assumption, whether we're lonely or we are all alone or not.
You start with it, or you agree with it all.
That we're each alone,
yeah.
In our own basic space or our own basic consciousness, but you say no wormholes. But you've just done a rather... which I say, illuminating presentation with us for maybe 45 minutes or so. So if there are no wormholes, what was the function of the presentation? What do you think that presentation meant? What could be achieved? What could be shared by you, you're doing that presentation?
Well, I'm not saying that we can't communicate about a lot of stuff. And of course we do. But in the end, there are things which are incommunicable. And deeply private to us, which we can even communicate that ineffability. We do. People who reflect on consciousness are continually come up about up against these basic intractable properties of qualia, including the fact that we don't seem to know how to express their actual qualities and their meaning to us in ways which we can pass across to other people. I think that is an amazing fact, and it's for human beings, it's enough to have the thoughts such as that about consciousness and all the other wonderful things we discover when we look at our own consciousness are what gives us our estimation of ourselves as metaphysically significant beings in the universe.
I think makes my question clear, because I'm granting to you the inaccessibility, mm-hmm. that a great deal of what is our consciousness seems to be inaccessible.
Did you say seems?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it is.
Okay.
But the point is, in community and in communication, particularly when we're dealing with, I think, the subtlety of what you were trying to communicate, at least what I perceived, you were trying to communicate in your presentation, it seemed to me that that even though a great deal of our consciousness may be inaccessible, there's also some leakage there. So the communication is not just this that you were trying to get us to share something of your sensibility, and there is some presumption of that sharing is possible. You know, there's some leakage, yes. Even if there's inaccessibility.
May I just sort of amplifying on that, or just something that I was thinking about? It seems to me that what you've just given us, and if it's a really eloquent summary of the human condition in many ways, and I especially like just kind of looking at, on both sides of things in a way, it seems to me, continuing from what Wendell said, that there are leakages, and I think what I come down to is that the fundamental thing about the human condition that makes it so damn difficult and so beautiful is that people manage to poke holes in various ways through the fundamental loneliness and communicate something. Gauguin did it even when he was doing paintings that revealed loneliness. He was poking a hole to all of us in saying something. And I think what really distinguishes art in particular, but sometimes scientific research and social actions, is that somebody takes a moral responsibility to come out of their hole and get something from inside themselves out there to other people.
I agree with you, and it is, it is what I'm trying to do, and this is what, as you say, particularly what artists have excelled at doing. I mean, through poetry or painting or music, for that matter, we do our best to reveal things of greater significance to us, and we, to some extent succeed. But I still think, philosophically, we have to recognize that it's only to some extent there are things which we simply can't know. And I think that that's a wonderful fact. I think it's an extraordinary fact. I mean, the fact that, in this room there are 16 centers of consciousness, each inviolable, each to the owner, the most precious thing in the world. And within the universe is such that everything is open to everything else in the universe, and yet just within this one room we've got this astonishing metaphysical fact of 16 centers itself, which seem to be in some level absolutely cut off from each other. One of the first person discoveries we make as little children. We don't believe it. There really is some reason to think children think that other people know what's in their minds, and to some extent they think what's going on and they know what's in other people's minds. Then they discover it. And, my daughter in a nursery school was coming back to me and saying, "Daddy, we've just been thinking about colours and whether what you see as red is the same thing as I see as red." She's deeply puzzled. Later on, people think this is just a cutscene, it's an old chestnut, and why even bother talk about it? Henry Wittgenstein said that such talk was meaningless, etc., etc. But actually, to every one of us, it's a discovery we make as lay philosophers, which we find it as a good thing. I think it would be quite interesting to look at, in terms of thinking of personal methodologies, at what point do children begin to make the remarkable discoveries about the nature of consciousness and to be interested in them and to speculate about what they mean and so on. I don't think people have taken that kind of investigation into developmental child psychology yet. They're interested in theory of mind in children and so on. But what children make of the facts of their own consciousness, I think we would find that they are speculating in remarkably deep ways from a very early point. I mean, every parent has stories about the amazing things which their children come up with, but we should take them deeply seriously. The children are making discoveries, and they're doing it without tutoring, just because It's the nature of human beings to inquire into what it's like to be themselves. And it's that practice which has, you know, Buddhists and so on bring to a peak as a whole way of life later on, thinking about what it's like to be me. But there's no human being who hasn't begun to do it. There's no chimpanzee which has begun to do it, would be my guess.
I hadn't realised that Aristotle's golden section might be kind of self resolved, taken by that, you know, this marvellous. And then I thought of Richard Lovelace and the snail. Do you know the poem?
No.
Wise emblem of our politic world, sage snail within my own self curled. Maybe no. Snails are all little. I'm a little alarmed. You know, it's the kind of, I think that you, humans are essentially social and lonely.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the examples you gave, people like Gates and Boga, Nietzsche, I'm very fond of Nietzsche in all sorts of ways, but they're depressors. I mean, it's a kind of self-fulfilling situation. Gates was incredibly cruel to his wife, and only because she decided she could do something exciting with automatic writing did she manage to get the power plant for a little while, and it still veered off to more done. I mean, if he had the opportunity, he would be incredibly happy to have a union with more fun. And I think he wouldn't have thought of himself as essentially lonely.
I suspect being yes, he would have done. But I mean, you're saying that people are simply the brush aside the fact that they can't penetrate someone else's mind and say what they can do is quite good enough for me and I'll get on with it.
I think the poets and artists clearly a bunch to choose from, because they especially the ones who do last into the next period of time, they have something which sets them apart. They write in a way that expresses.
Well, so it may be true that the artists I've quoted have what they've made of this virginity of the soul is to make it into a tragic thing. I don't think it's any of such people who are aware of it and or even celebrate it. I mean, it's, you know, a penny for your thoughts is such a familiar notion as a relationship with someone else. We don't know what's going on in there. The fact that we don't know what's going on in there is essential to our understanding of the dignity of other human beings. I mean, I think if we were all open books to each other, we wouldn't have we wouldn't take people seriously in the ways that we actually are obliged to, because we recognise that in someone else, whoever they may be, you know, doesn't matter their status in any other way, every human being has a centre of self which is as secret and wonderful as I am.
I think we're going to disagree on two things. I think the first is that I don't think that the self is anything other than a momentary percept. I think I'm very human in this. I think of persons as things which are have a longer duration, and they're things which are structured narratives, either from an internal first person or a third person account, maybe even a second person account. But I think of persons as being those things that
I accept the word person, and then it puts souls are momentary, they don't exist at all, presumably. So what you're saying is, I think a person is a construction on a self, but the self is given to us, first of all, because of our experience of sensation. I think sensation constitutes our initial recognition of there being something worth taking seriously at the centre of our psychical existence. Yes.
I was going to say something, so I already was going to speak.
Well, okay. Going back to the quote from Wittgenstein, there's another quote, very short quote, a few pages before or after, in the same volume in the Philosophical Investigations, which arrested me when I was really struggling over the other mind's problem as an undergraduate. And it's simply, just try in a real case to doubt someone's fear or pain. And
but see, I the point is not that in many cases you don't know that someone's in pain, but that you don't know what the pain is like for them is.
Well, okay, so then there are maybe two aspects to, I mean, this was, I sort of had that thought as well. Then there are two aspects to the other mind's problem, and which I think is probably a useful point that you might be making. But I still wonder whether it seems to me there are like two gestalts we could have on this situation. One is the one that you've been very ably articulating, and which is part of this tradition of sort of skepticism about our minds, I guess. But there's another one, which is, you know, which is expressed in that sort of challenge by Wittgenstein, and also in a passage by Max Scheler, which is quoted in a wonderful paper by Dan Zahavi about empathy, which I don't know if you know the paper. Scheler says something very, very similar. It says basically, you know, when we look on the face of people, we can see their distress. Or their anger or their amusement or whatever. And the idea is, I think that what Scheler was getting at was that, that the phenomenon of distress is not just, that's my beef problem, is not just, if you like, the inner feeling. It's much broader than that. And it's something which is outward as well as inward. Yep. And actually, to some extent, and in some circumstances, and this is my kind of additional gloss on this idea, it can sometimes be more accessible to others than to the person themselves, because they may be repressing it or hiding it from themselves for all sorts of reasons, or not failing to notice it in themselves. For all sorts of reasons. So for the moment, you know, I'm often conscious of the fact that, you know, people are conscious of things in me that I'm not conscious in myself, as it were, in my behaviour. For example, I might be talking very quickly and expressing a kind of nervousness which I'm not actually, you know, isn't in my consciousness. So if, you know, the beeper were going, I wouldn't actually
be registering that as part of my consciousness.
You're aware of it in me. So yeah. I'm just giving that as a...
No, it's a very interesting example. It's not an example of reading minds. It's not an example of reading consciousness, because if you're not conscious of it, I'm reading something about your disposition or your mood.
Well, I'm actually questioning that. I'm wondering whether, our concept of consciousness as this kind of point of private, the thisness that's going on in here, is actually a bit of a mystification, or at least from this opposite gestalt. I don't know which of these gestalts are true, but I think they both deserve their say.
No, I agree with you.
I think they have to be said together. It's a bit like the duck rabbit.
Well, I mean, over the last 30 years, I've been saying your side of it, probably much more time on it than on this later take on it. Of course, I think that reading other people's minds is, insofar as you can, and being able to recognise what they're likely to do next and so on, has been the most significant advance in human cognition, the advance which made us into human beings. It allowed us to be social in ways which no other animal can be. While that's true that we, and it's particularly true that social emotions we express on the outside because we want to be read. Emotions are designed to be shared and to be public. That's
it's not just emotions.
But look at the red screen.
It's not just emotions in their social sense, because, you know, if someone is, just going back to a case where there's no kind of difference. You know, there's no question that the person is experiencing something, and supposing someone is walking in the forest and gets their, this is a gruesome example, gets their foot in caught in a man trap, and, you know, they're in agony. Now, you know, they experience this agony. We don't experience
the agony, but we see that we do, well, in one sense we experience their agony because we see them in agony. It's like if the stove were on, yeah, we would be we would see the stove's heat. Mm-hmm. Of course we wouldn't be inside the stove, you know. So but I don't, you know, what I'm saying is that from in those real cases, the phenomenon is not one of something inside and we see the signs of it, but rather we see the phenomenon, but we see it from our perspective rather than from another perspective. And there's, you know, there's the perspective of the person themselves undergoing this terrible, gruesome agony, and there's the perspective of the onlooker seeing the agony, the person's agony.
Can I follow in on that? Because it's related to the point I was going to make, the observation I was going to make. It seems to me that what you're saying about the self is really important and true. But if I were going to be looking at that as a question that is a first-person inquiry, the question that I would want to ask is, what is it like to be a self? And is it possible to bury that in some way? Is it possible to change the experience of being the self? Because everything you say follows once you adopt a certain position as to what it means to be a self. But if you could conduct a first-person inquiry at that level, then things might turn out quite differently. And in part, I think that's what Steve is saying. We do have an experience. There isn't, you know... Let's say you drop the pronouns, or what was the pronouns? My, and so on.
Possessive
pronouns, yes. Let's say you drop the possessive pronouns, and then you'd have to come up with a somewhat different vocabulary. And you'd say, well, there's an experience over here of you know, there's not the experience of being caught in the trap, but it is an experience. There's an experience over here. There's no doubt there are different experiences, but... The reason that becomes problematic and we get into issues of virginity and loneliness and so on is because I'm really intent on this being my experience and that's your experience. So maybe it would be fruitful to look at that level and see what could be investigated.
Can I just follow up? Mm-hmm. I totally agree with Jack and Susan as well. Jay, Van Gogh, all you quoted, are the depressive guys, are the lonely guys, and I think that, I don't know why didn't you quote Hafiz or Rumi or the guys who found unique, some kind of merger with others or unitement with, for example, Rumi speaks a lot about sexual relationships that are fulfilling and without this post-coital loneliness.
Even John Donne.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
John Donne's no minus.
I want to come out that actually you were speaking about yourself there. That was like autobiography, as each of us do.
Mm-hmm.
And which is fantastic, which is the uniqueness you were mentioning, but probably not the loneliness. And I want to ask why not taking this into account and not selling this as an intersubjective science? Because in the course of your talk, it was fascinating. I really liked it. I really was into it. But I could immediately think of some theories that are opposite of what you're saying, and obviously there are others have similar ideas. So it is this big danger when we go into first-person phenomena, the description of it, that we become very intellectual and very theoretical. But if considering the same phenomena from first-person perspective, then it becomes very real, very truthful, and there is almost no space for doubting about it. So why not just using what you were telling us, that we are unique and that there is like no way we can for sure know what the others are thinking, and somehow take this as a ground for first-person research and not trying to be scientific in the way you were trying to say that science is like intersubjective and there is no point in researching things that are just for me.
I didn't say I'm not. I also said there's no point in researching.
I'm sorry, then I misunderstood you yesterday. You said this is not a science. We are just doing our research in my private.
No. The response to what you said yesterday was when you said that perhaps in something about changing your consciousness. I said, well, I mean, yes, that's an interesting consequence of the of our consciousness that we can conduct these experiments.
But is it possible
and change
to do anything without changing our consciousness?
No, but what I said was that for the science of consciousness is that from my point of view would be about what is what it, insofar as we possess a way of self-experience which we can manipulate and change and even to some extent believe that we share with other people. That's one of the most interesting facts about consciousness. That fact we then have to decide what to do with. And from my point of view, that's I once been asked, well, why have we been given a faculty which allows us to conduct these exercises and to come up with the answers we do and so on. And my answer to that is because it makes us more interesting and better people in the end. But the fact that it's an illusion may also be, you know, a truth which we can investigate scientifically. So, these claims we make about what we've just done and what kind of people we are and so on, and even about sharing consciousness. I mean, in relation to sex, for example, I remember a good friend of mine, Tony Marcel, does anyone know Tony? who, you know, having a furious argument with me about how he could feel himself inside somebody else's body when he was having sex. And it's a very interesting claim that he could actually feel sensations in someone else's body. There's actually some very interesting work now on the projection of sensations about the precise conditions under which you may have the illusion that you're feeling something outside your own body, not only in someone else's hand, but even in the desk, for example. But no one would want to say this is anything other than an illusion. The question is, what kind of illusions do we experience, and what kind of truth do we experience? And those are all, you know, that's the natural history of consciousness. Let's find as much about it as we possibly can. Next question is, let's ask what underlies these, what kind of truth value do they have, and why might we have been designed, in some cases, to be under the illusion? Let me show you another slide. This is the slide I would like to be. It comes from what's called New Lecture. This isn't.
Did you call these lovely people?
People in the prop? No, I copied them from somewhere. I can't remember. Okay, look, there's. What did I press to get onto F5, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Don't bother. No, I've gone right away. How do you actually get to the one you want?
Go to the bottom. You see there are three little icons just above the word draw at the bottom left.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, the right one. That's it.
Okay, now, I mean, that's a very familiar thing. There's no question about the first person account we would give of that. We're seeing, we can describe a triangle which you know, and all its features. It's a propositional object which we can describe quite well. Now, we all know that you know, you can make a real one of those. But you have to construct it. You have to construct it in a very special way and see it from a very particular angle. Now, this isn't a direct analogy, but I think that certain aspects of our consciousness have been designed to share to us like that, whereas in fact, they're like that. This is the demonstration I wanted to give you. We did need the sound on this, but listen very hard. You might here's somebody constructing an impossible object. seen, you've probably seen this before, it's very popular. Did you know you can make your own three-dimensional one?
Is this from Discovery Channel?
Put in the right position and impressed that you've got the impossible object. Now, I think this is a very nice allegory for what has happened in the design of our own minds. We have had certain illusions constructed because the payoff is that we think we are something which we really are not, that we have an immaterial soul or whatever it might be, and the advantage of that way of thinking about ourselves is that it creates all those ambitions and the glories that we call human civilization.
It's quasi-Leibnizian, isn't it?
How is it?
Leibniz says that all of this is an appearance. It's none of this is real. There's no extension. There's no substance. Yeah. None of this. But it's a very handy illusion.
But he wouldn't have thought of that. I mean, he didn't ask why it's a handy thing. I mean, I'm close, of course, to Daniel Dennett on a lot of this stuff. But what Dennett has resisted so far is asking, he thinks it's all a mistake. We just make mistakes about consciousness, and we need to be talked out of them in a way. And I think we make mistakes of a sort, but if we were talked out of them, we would become inhuman. To some extent, if we were, not only would we not want to be talked out of them, we actually want to be designing, as we get to designing machines to take over from humans, we may have to build these solutions into them, or else they'll self-destruct. If we ever get to designing surrogates for ourselves to go off and explore the galaxies, for example, they are going to have to, at some point, they're going to start reflecting on just who and what they are. They're going to need comforting illusions like that they have souls and have designed them and everything else.
This illusion of care is for Nietzsche what brings the herd to their knees.
Well, Nietzsche didn't think this was an illusion. I mean, Nietzsche said the opposite.
That's right. Okay,
why don't you finish and then.
Yes, we need to give Chasm. Yes.
Well, I sense deep inconsistency in your theory. Because you operate with terms like truth and illusion, and on the other hand you say we don't have any access to other people's experience. So how do you...
I didn't say we don't have any access, I said we don't have full access.
Okay. But I still don't understand how then do you, if I can not see what the other person or experience what the other person experiences, even in waiting for my talk, or your picture. So how do I really define what is true and what is not true?
So what is that about? What true of what?
You are speaking of illusions of first person.
Well, I mean, let me give you the illusion that we have an immortal soul. Okay, that is a very widely spread belief. I think I would want to claim that it is a false one.
How would you
wait?
Wait, I want to get to the end of this discussion before we break.
Right. Why don't we take a break and continue?
Yes.
Okay. I just wonder how many people can wiggle their right big toes when Nick was talking about
that.
Everybody could.
Yeah. Mentally.
Interesting, often you know, right big tone when I describe it verbally. You know what what mirror neurons do, interesting enough, is they mirror, so that if I do that, Susan would be wiggling her left. I mean, her mirror neurons would be. Yes, cortically.
Isn't that part of the autonomous nervous system, the mirror neurons rather than...
Sorry? Autonomous?
They're part of the autonomous nervous system.
Autonomic.
No, they're not.
They're not.
Okay, let's take a break.
Thank you very much. Yes.
I wanted to say that.
Thank you.
It's so good.
This actually, this talk has just been published. It's
really
Okay.
Okay.
So don't, please don't hesitate to interrupt me if my English is not understandable. Okay? I would like to try to describe in the first person why and how I'm interested in studying consciousness in the first person. More precisely, I would like to share with you what I have learned, what I have discovered, what has surprised me the most since I began to study lived experience concretely with specific tools. I will emphasize surprises that are not only intellectual, but open a doorway towards an interior transformation. In order to investigate lived experience, I use a set of interview techniques which enables a person to become conscious of his or her subjective experience and describe it in detail. My goal here for this presentation is not to present these techniques, but I just want to... I'm not in the right mode.
No, just take page down. It should work. Yes, it here. Yes? No?
Yes, but it's not so that... Oh, yes, it is. It's okay.
Yes?
Okay, thank you. I just want to mention that I have been using these techniques in three main contexts. First, in the context of my doctoral thesis under the supervision of Francisco Varela. The goal was to describe the subjective experience that accompanies the appearance of an intuition. I then used this method as part of a neurophenomenological project on the anticipation of epileptic seizures initiated by Francisco Varela too. In order to obtain from epileptic patients a detailed description of the subtle internal sensations which announce the onset of a seizure. Lastly, for more than 10 years now, I've been teaching this interview technique to various groups of students and researchers. This led me to collect precise first-person descriptions of various know-how in the sportive, artistic, relational, and cognitive domains. How to compose or to listen to a piece of music. How to climb an ice face. To make needlepoint lace. To listen to a patient. To forgive someone who has hurt you. To write a poem. Most students are fascinated by this exploration of their subjective experience. What's the most surprising for them, and which never fails to surprise me too, is discovering that an important part of their cognitive activity remains outside their field of consciousness. After at least 15 years of study, it's very disconcerting for them to realize that they are so unaware of themselves. During this period, I've been practicing with Tibetan masters Buddhist techniques for exploring consciousness, most notably shamatha and vipassana. My first surprise...
It should actually just...
This one?
Wait a second. But yeah, you're here.
Okay. Oh, yeah, okay.
It didn't work. No, wait. It's right here. It's nicely on your side. It doesn't work here at that moment.
Okay.
Go back into slideshow. I'm sorry, can I get the front and side decks? Okay.
Okay.
Yep. So just the page down, sure.
Those electrons balanced. Keep the electrons balanced.
Oh, there is no title. There is no title.
Oh, that's because, Jane, do you want to take a look at something about this issue of getting it? The whole thing doesn't quite show up on the screen. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yes, but I hate to spend 15 minutes on it.
15 minutes is too much. Let's, what we could do.
Let's read the title.
If you just change the resolution, or you can just show the upper part of the screen, so the page number will be lost, which is probably.
If you actually move the mouse to the top.
We could do that, but let's see if we take it. If we can take it, see if this works. Does it help? No, that doesn't help at all. Okay. Well, you can slide. Let's see. No. If we go up here. Okay.
Yes.
So, that's good like that. Okay.
Something disappears on the bottom, you can just read it to us.
Yeah. Yes, okay. Okay. My first surprise was to discover that accessing one's own subjective experience is neither immediate nor easy, as my lived experience is the most personal and intimate thing about me. I think I'm familiar with it, and cannot imagine for a moment that any particular inner effort should be necessary to become aware of it. However, if I ask you to describe precisely your strategies of memorization, or how you proceed in writing a letter or an article, it's very likely that in a first stage I would obtain quite poor descriptions. Or I could ask you to carry out a very simple cognitive task, for example, to spell a given word or to memorize a list of numbers, which would be very easy. But if I asked you then, how did you proceed in carrying out this task, it would probably very much difficult for you to answer me precisely without the help of adapted questioning. All of us know how to carry out such tasks. But we have only a very partial awareness of the way we proceed. A large part of our experience is pre-reflective. That is to say, although it is lived through subjectively, it is not immediately accessible to consciousness, introspection, or verbal description. The most surprising thing is that not only do we do not know how we proceed, but we do not know that we do not know. In other words, we are not aware of being unaware, which is the first obstacle in the way of becoming conscious. Why should I set myself the task of acquiring a consciousness which I am not aware that I lack? What is more, we believe that we know. That is to say, in many cases, we have a mistaken representation of our cognitive activity, a representation to which we hold very firmly, and this makes it all the more difficult to become conscious of how it actually takes place. Here is my second surprise. This is the
surprise. I'm sorry. That should have worked. Page down. Yes. But it didn't. Huh. Mine. So, you know, I'm not necessarily the best person because I'm not so familiar with PowerPoint myself, but it's my computer, so I guess I. Yeah, well, you take page down. I did page down is what we're using, but let's try enter instead. Okay, enter works. Hit enter.
You might want to move the screen down.
May I move the screen down again? Okay.
You could pan around the picture with the mouse.
Yeah. Well, if there were a mouse.
Maybe Claire can just read us some title.
That's quite close. Quite close. You're missing the last couple of lines.
You can see it on your.
You can see it on the screen here.
Yes, I can see it. Yes, okay. Okay, my second surprise. Under given conditions, it's possible to become aware of this pre-reflective dimension. This awareness requires carrying out very precise interior gestures, which may be learned and practiced. For example, we have to learn to stabilize our attention, which is usually extremely capricious, on the particular experience that we are exploring. We have to identify and abandon the beliefs and representations which surreptitiously substitute for the description of the experience itself. We also have to redirect our attention from the content of the experience, the what, which usually entirely occupies us, towards the modes of appearance of this content, the how. Here was a citation of Varela and Scheer. There are numerous instances where we perceive phenomena pre-reflexively without being consciously aware of them, but where a gesture or method of examination will clarify or even bring this pre-reflexive phenomena to the fore.
Can you give us an example? Are you going to?
I'm going to. I would like to invite you to participate in a small experiment. Okay? Take your time, here and now, to imagine a cherry tree in bloom. A cherry tree in bloom. And just raise your hand when you have got this image. Okay. Now, I would like you to answer in your head the following questions. Did this cherry tree appear in colors or in black and white? Was this image clear or fuzzy? Was it light or dark out? Was the image stable or fleeting? Was it a constructed image? I mean a shady tree that you had never seen before. Or a remembered image? A tree that you know personally? Was this image accompanied by sounds? By smells? By bodily sensations? Did you see this image from outside as if it was a photograph or a film? Or were you in the location of the tree? Let's have a little show of hands. How many of you saw a photograph? Photo?
Painting.
Or painting.
From a distance.
Yes, from a distance. As if...
I mean, as if you're seeing an image or as if you're seeing it from a distance?
As if you're seeing an image. A photo.
Well, in other words, I suppose you could have been like in among the leaves, right? Do you see it as if you're seeing a photograph or painting?
Yes, that's right. Oh, I see. You're not in the.
Yeah.
In the scene. You see from a distance. Yeah. Okay, so nobody saw a photo.
We all, most of us, too.
Okay, oh, so how many saw a photo? How many of you?
So what? Okay. A photo.
A photo.
Like a,
okay. Yeah. Okay, thank you. And how many of you were in the location of the tree, in the scene? Okay. Now, silently consider this question. For those of you who saw a photo, how big was it? Where did you see it? Up, down, to the right, to the left? How far in front of you was this image? For those of you who were in the location of the tree, were you in your own skin? Were you in the skin of another person in this scene? Or were you viewing the scene as a neutral third party? And in the two last cases, I mean, if you were in the skin of another person or a neutral third party, did you see yourself looking at the tree? Okay. And for all of you, did this image appear complete at all at once, or did it develop progressively? And in this last case, which elements were the first to appear and the last? Was the final image preceded by other candidate images? Was it preceded by elements other than visual?
I'm sorry, what was that last one?
Was it preceded by elements other than visual? For example, from the instant where I asked you to imagine a cherry tree in bloom, did you say something to yourself? Did you feel particular sensations or emotions? Did anything else happen? And at what point precisely did you feel that you had fulfilled the task to imagine a cherry tree in bloom? Here is a final question. How did you proceed to answer my questions? For example, I just asked you if there were other candidate images. How did you go about answering me? Oh, so, what's the aim of such questions? It's to redirect your attention from the content of the image, the cherry tree in bloom, that usually completely absorb your attention, towards the pre-reflective dimensions of the experience, on which we are not trained to focus our attention. In the first stage, we explored the structural characteristic of the image, its size, color, distance. In a second stage, we explored the process of emergence of the image, its genesis. I asked you to divert your attention from the picture once it was set in your mind, it was stabilized, towards the dynamics of its appearance, its process of constitution. That is the different, generally very rapid phases that have preceded its stabilization. And at every phase, the very rapid succession of interior micro gestures that you made to evoke this image, to stabilize it, to recognize it, evaluate it, and eventually to discard it. Thus, a set of interview techniques can enable the researcher to help the interviewed person to carry out these refocusing gestures. These gestures permit the interviewee to become progressively aware of the pre-reflective part of his experience and to describe it, often with great surprise. Even if the interviewee has started the session by saying, I don't know what I do, or I do nothing, or I know how to do it, but I cannot tell you how. A moment comes when he begins to speak slowly from an interior space where he is in contact with his own experience. Then he describes it with an often unexpected degree of detail. When it's possible to lead successive explicitation sessions for a given experience or type of experience, each session enables the interviewed person to become aware of new aspects of his experience.
Can I interrupt or
yes.
Or rather, when you say that he's accessing his experience, why do we believe that's theoretical? I'll just give you an example. You know the phenomenon of choice blindness. It's a remarkable experiment that Patrick Owens has done, in which he gives people two faces to choose between. He asks in which they think is the most pretty, okay? And they choose one, okay? And they then take that card. And they then have to explain why they chose it. But actually, he's performed a sleight of hand. And so he gives them not the one they chose, but the other one. Subjects don't notice this and will then proceed to give explanation for why they chose the one they didn't choose. And in that case, they're clearly accessing not their actual experience, but a replication of what the expert might have been or their reasons might have been.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm sorry, I don't really, I can't answer because I don't really understand what you just explained, the experience. Maybe we can talk of that afterwards. And Steve is going to translate to Ellen. Excuse me, Nick. Thus, it seems that... I'm sorry. It seems that subjective experience and even an experience reputed as indescribable as the emergence of an intuition can be described. At least it seems that the point where description stops can be considerably pushed back. If our vocabulary for describing the subjective experience is so poor, it's mainly due to the fact that this experience has been little explored in our culture. But when we lack the words, as James said, what stops us from creating precise concepts and words for referring to experience and communication about it? It's one of the very conditions of possibility of a science of subjective experience. My third surprise, so it's... Okay. What's the following? Our experience is not just a draft, but has a very precise synchronic and diachronic structure. Thus, it's possible to, through a work of progressive abstraction from the collected descriptions, to compare these structures in order to identify for a given type of experience generic experiential characteristics and variants. For example, the synchronic structure of an image may be characterized by the abstract variable number of dimensions, two or three dimensions. It may also be characterized by the perceptual position of the subject in relation with the imaging scene. He may see the scene from outside, or may leave the scene as if he was in his own body, through his own eyes, or live and see the scene through the eyes of someone else. Some authors speak of the first position, second position, and third position of perception. Gallagher introduced slightly different descriptive categories. First and third person egocentric perspective, first and third person allocentric perspective. It's also possible to highlight the diachronic structure of different instances of a given type of experience, and then to compare these structures in order to detect a generic structure and variance. Such a generic structure is usually composed of a succession of precise operations, subtle transformations of the direction, intensity, scope, and source of the attention, modification of the perceptual position, very implicit operations of appreciation, verification, comparison, for example, of the present experience with past experiences. For example, analyzing and comparing the description I had collected of intuitive experiences led me to identify a succession of very precise interior gestures with a striking regularity from one experience to the other and from one subject to the other. In other words, a generic structure of intuitive experience. Now, I would like to propose how this dynamic character of our lived experience is the cornerstone of a possible science of lived experience. First of all, the gestures which enable us to become aware of our lived experience and to describe it also have a structure. This enables us to study consciousness in a rigorous and scientific way. In effect, becoming aware of one's experience and describing it is an experience in itself. For example, let's take the experience of... Oh, no, it's not good because...
You can just do it yourself if you take this and go. You see where you see that it's up there now. Once you're here, you can move it around up and down like that. So is that okay? Where you have? Well, yeah.
For example, let's take the experience of imagining a cherry tree in bloom. A possible description of this experience could be, the location of the tree. Description from which we extract the descriptive category, first person perceptual position. But producing such a description is also an experience. Okay? The prediction, the act of describing it is also an experience in itself. And for this particular experience, as for the others, it is possible to turn one's attention from the what, I mean in this case, from the content of the description, to the how, that is, the way this description is produced, and to the question is, how do I proceed in order to stabilize my attention of the experience to be described? How do I proceed in order to pass from the verbalization of my representations, commentaries, and beliefs about my experience towards the description of the experience itself? How do I proceed to reorient my attention from the what to the how of this experience? For example, a moment ago, I asked you to imagine a cherry tree in bloom. I could now ask you, how did you proceed a moment ago when I asked you if this image was in black and white or in color? When I asked you if you were seeing the image from the outside of or if you were in the location of the tree? When I asked you if this image had been preceded by other candidate images or by anything else. I've never the time now, nor the linguistic capacity to carry out an explicitation interview with all of you, but such an interview would probably show that in order to answer my questions precisely, you have no solution except to call back, to refresh, okay, to presentify this just past experience. I mean, not only the visual image of the cherry tree, but the whole experience which led to the emergence of this image. Such a gest of... Such a gest of refreshment of a past experience is a very specific gesture, which may be achieved in a more or less precise, efficient way. For example, it has been observed that this type of memory is involuntary. It does not occur on the initiative of discursive thought. Instead, it occurs spontaneously, usually through the intermediary of a sensorial trigger. The memory cannot therefore be deliberately set off, but it's possible to indirectly prepare for its emergence by rediscovering the sensations linked to the experience. For example, if I asked you, what's the first thought you had when you woke up this morning, except for you who didn't wake up? It's quite probable that there would be no way for recovering this memory other than returning in thought to your bed at the moment when you awoke. Therefore, the trigger may be visual. In order to remember the experience, you recall the visual context of the experience, what you were seeing at that moment. The trigger may be auditory. You recall the sounds such as the birds singing or the alarm clock going off. It may be kinesthetic. You recall, for example, the position of your body. It may be olfactory or gustative, as in Proust's well-known Madeleine, the evocation of which enabled him to recall very precisely one scene and then whole chapters of his childhood. It was also observed that the perceptual position you adopt in the evoked scene determines the type of pre-reflective information you can access. For describing the visual context, it's generally sufficient to see the scene again as it was a film. But for accessing and describing precisely the bodily sensations you were feeling, or the sounds you were hearing, you have to enter your body to relive the past situation. In other words, you have to adopt a first-person perceptual position. Subjective and objective criteria for checking the success of the presentification gesture or the intensity of the induced state of evocation have also been identified. The objective indicators are the best known. They are verbal, nonverbal, and paraverbal. The verbal indicators are the use of the word I, the present tense, specific context indicators of place and time, the concrete and detailed character as opposed to conceptual and generic of the vocabulary used. All these signs indicate that the subject is making efforts to describe a particular situation, and that is not in the process of reciting theoretical knowledge. An example of non-verbal indicator is the direction of the eyes. When the subject is reliving the past experience, it takes his eyes off the interviewer to look into space, to the horizon. At the same time, the flow of speech usually slows down, and the words are often cut with silence. These paraverbal clues are the sign that the subject is plunging into himself to make contact with the pre-reflective dimension of his experience. At the same time, usually co-verbal gestures appear. These usually unconscious gestures, which occur even with blind people, and even when the interviewer cannot see them, does not seem to be intended to transmit information to the interviewer, but rather they occur because the subject is in contact or attempting to make contact with his distant past or recent past experience. Also, subjective criteria have not been extensively researched. The average person who has just been evoking a past situation, if this person is asked to evaluate the degree of intensity of this evocation on a scale from 1 to 10, he or she knows very well how to answer. This proves that he has some very implicit internal criteria. This particular internal state, where the subject is in close contact with his experience, has been dubbed an embodied utterance position. Utterance is
embodied utterance.
Utterance position. Embodied utterance position. In my opinion, it's very close to what Jacques calls a storytelling position, as opposed to a narrative position, where the subject is not in contact with his experience, but instead describes a vague memory of his experience, or his representations, beliefs, or judgments about his experience. Such a narrative position may be adopted even for a present experience. From this perspective, in my opinion, the main question is not, is the described experience present, or recent past, or distant past, but rather, how do you relate to your experience? In other words, do you adopt an embodied or disembodied position, a narrative or a storyteller position, in order to describe it? Thus, we can see that the gesture I've written the gesture.
Do you want someone to sort of navigate?
Yeah, well,
yes,
let me get in behind you.
Thank you.
You want to go to the top?
Yes, thank you.
You
thank yes. you. Thus, we can see that the gesture of presentification is very precise and may be achieved in a more or less efficient way. It's possible to describe this gesture as a definite succession of precise internal operations and to identify its structure. In my opinion, it's very important. Since this gesture has a structure, it's possible to compare different occurrences of this gesture and consequently to detect its regularities and variance, and evaluate the precision and efficiency of this variance. It's possible to refine and to control this gesture, and to improve the techniques enabling an interviewer to elicit it. And this is true for the other gestures enabling us to become conscious of our experience. Becoming aware is not a random event. Instead, it's a result of a definite process. It's possible to verify through precise criteria that this process has been accurately achieved. The gestures enabling us to become conscious may be refined and practiced. In the course of a learning process, the phases of which correspond to various degrees of mastering these gestures. And these mastering degrees can also be evaluated through precise criteria. These gestures and the techniques proposed by the different methods for eliciting them cannot therefore be evaluated through theoretical knowledge. Through representation and presupposition about these gestures, or through third-person studies only, but rather through careful first-person descriptions. This is why our current research in my group in France consists of studying in a way that Merleau-Ponty calls surreflective. With the explicitation tools themselves, the various moments and different dimensions of the act of becoming aware, the inner gestures that enable me to evoke a past experience, that enable me to divert my attention from what to how, that enable me to direct my attention to the various dimensions of my experience, that enable me to alternate verbal description and refreshment of the past experience. The first attempts at describing and comparing these gestures in different methods are very interesting because they show a convergence among them. For example, Francisco Varela, Pierre Vermersch, and Nathalie Duprat began to compare the process of becoming aware in second-person techniques and in Buddhist techniques of meditation. A first sketch of a generic structure of the act of becoming aware emerged from this comparison. This structure is very similar to the structure that I had begun to highlight when I compared the process of emergence of an intuition and the process of focusing described by Jundling. At this point, I would like to comment on the appropriateness of this dynamic approach for a science of consciousness. In my opinion, it is in this direction that first-person researchers should concentrate and combine their efforts. The goal could be to realize a meta-description, I mean, a description of the dynamic structure of the process of becoming aware, in order to make a science of consciousness possible. This delicate work has only recently been sketched out by a group of French researchers composed of a dozen psychologists, psychiatrists, neurologists, philosophers, and epistemologists, a very stronger team.
Yes. Coming to you.
The dynamic character of lived experience thus enables it to study consciousness in a scientific way. But this dynamic character.
Sorry, I don't know what I'm doing.
Sorry. Yes, the dynamic character of lived experience has another important consequence. Because lived experience has a dynamic structure that we can become aware of, we can transform this experience. This opens an unexpected perspective in the pedagogical, therapeutic, and existential domains. For example, I'm not condemned to have a poor memory, for I can transform the precise sequence of inner micro operations that I carry out to memories or to remembrance once I have become aware of them. Developing an early consciousness of the subtle symptoms that precede the emergence of an emotion and the interior micro-gestures that maintain and amplify it enables me to learn to calm the emotional process before it eventually causes me to suffer. In the medical field... The possibility for the patient to refine the awareness of his internal processes also opens up new perspectives. For example, an appropriate training enables epileptic patients, like the young boy, to become aware of the subtle symptoms that announce the onset of a seizure, and to set up countermeasures to interrupt it. This opens up an unexpected line of research towards a non-pharmacological therapy of epilepsy, and perhaps another understanding of this illness.
Sorry, Claire, can I just ask, I know it's rude to interrupt at this stage, but I'm just fascinated. Do you have, is there good historic evidence that the child was is having, that Raphael was depicting the onset of an epileptic seizure there?
Oh, no.
Is it just your
No. No, I think there is good historical evidence that the child is having a seizure, but that's all. looking beyond epilepsy, taking into account the patient's subjective experience could greatly improve the prevention and treatment of many illnesses and transform our vision of them. Now I come to the last part of my presentation. I am going to shorten it very, very much. In fact, what I found the most surprising is the following. Exploring, thanks to explicitation and meditation techniques, the early phases of our cognitive processes. Whether it is the emergence of an idea, of a memory, of an emotion, or a perception, leads us to discover a dimension of our experience whose structure is very different from its more superficial structure. First, the borderline between the different sensory modes looks far more permeable in this dimension than in our more conscious experience. This transmodality is associated with the transformation of the separation usually perceived between the interior world and the outside world, the objective pole and the subjective pole. This separation is described in these early stages of our cognitive processes, when we can become aware of it and describe them, this separation between inside and outside, and between the different sensory modes, is described as far less rigid or even absent. The exploration of this initial dimension and the micro-dynamism animating us thus suggests the following working hypothesis. I have to shift away. No, not this one. Okay. Following working hypothesis. Differentiation, this hypothesis is very close to the inaction theory, in fact. Differentiation between interior and exterior, between a subject and an object pole, and among distinct sensorial modalities is not given, but created and sustained moment after moment by a pre-reflective microactivity consisting of tiny gestures of distinction, identification, recognition, categorization, appreciation. As these gestures are very subtle, they are usually unrecognized. Only the result of this complex microgenesis usually appears to our consciousness under the shape of a stable world and a solid and separated self. But thanks to a particular training, it's possible to become aware of this source dimension of our experience and to renew contact with it. It's possible to become aware of the minute gestures through which we build and grab hold of our world, and also to loosen that grip. This loosening is a great relief. It opens a space which is much vaster, much open and more fluid than our usual space. In conclusion, because this experience has a dynamic structure, a genesis, of which it's possible to become aware, we can not only study this experience in a rigorous way, but also transform this experience, that is, transform the way we relate to the world, even at a very deep level. We can become aware of the minute gestures in which suffering originates and transform them. In fact, this microgenesis and its process of inversion have been little explored in our culture, probably because we didn't have the adequate tools to carry out this exploration. However, the recent refinements of our first and second person techniques for exploring consciousness, which enable us to renew contact with this dimension and explore it in a rigorous way, could considerably transform not only our understanding of cognition, but also the way we live in the world. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Oh, sure.
I try to answer questions, to understand questions and then answer.
Don't worry, I have Steve here.
Yeah.
And I will make it as simple as I can, not in any patronizing way,
yeah,
but for my own benefit. This is not really a question, this is a request for information,
mm-hmm,
or further definition, because I find the term pre-reflexive something that I want to know more about. Reflexive, I think of as something like a loud noise happens in this room now, and we will all do pretty much the same things. Our muscles will tense, and we will make jumping gestures or whatever. Now, that is a reflex. There are many good examples. But when I look at somebody I know, or I look at a scene that I recognize, I suppose there are some sort of reflexive classifications that I make. I recognize something as a treat, or as a matter of historical fact, I was standing with Francisco in the courtyard at Dartington at a conference about 10 years ago, and a very attractive girl walked by, and he and I were talking, and we both stopped for the same reason. It's a man thing. It was a pleasant interruption to recognize that we both have had our attention redirected from the conversation that we are having to something else that wasn't part of the conversation, but as it were, it came to get us rather than, we didn't stand around there looking for beautiful girls, but one came along and there you go.
That's what you tell us, John.
Yeah. and the point about this, it eventually is a question.
Do you need translation so far?
No, so far. Thank you.
What is this pre-reflexive content that the message I'm taking away from what you have said is that there is a level of first-person experience that I can learn to become aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And you, is that pre-reflexive experience?
Because I think there's going to be a vocabulary problem, not only in French, but in the English. Because I think there's a tremendous confusion in English between the word reflexive and reflective.
Yes. Yes.
And I think that's what it comes down to. Okay, so. Yeah.
Yes, but it's not clear. I think it's clear from nobody. We had a meeting in Paris with Sean Gallagher and Dan Zavi and a lot of people, and we couldn't agree on this word. In fact, I personally prefer the word pre-reflective.
Ah, no, that's
pre-reflective. Yes, but it's confusing. Right. Because in Varela, on the citations that I quoted, use pre-reflexive. But I think he used pre-reflexive we use the this word in the same meaning. But it's nothing, rien à voir with reflex. It's completely different.
In French, it's got an X.
Yes, it's related with consciousness, just where conscious, are we completely conscious of, for example, when you saw this girl, you were conscious of her nice hair, or I don't know what. I don't want to have the details. But
your presentation, you tell us more about it.
You were probably pre-reflectively conscious of our fit in your shoes, or of some very rapid thoughts that came in your mind. And if I had been there and asked you, or Russ had been there here and asked you what just happened to you, you just answer something about the girl, and not of all these sounds, thoughts and emotions that were pre-reflective.
Right.
I'm not sure.
No, you and Jack again. I mean, if you had said pre-reflective, then I would have been quiet.
Okay.
That was no problem.
Okay.
Okay, that's a great mistake. Yeah. Can I just last thing? Recently, I was in a discussion with it was a CEP conference 2 years ago. They talked about the grabbiness.
Oh yeah,
the grabbiness. You know, grab, mm-hmm. like that. Something. You know, we think of sensation. Nick was talking about
it pulls your attention.
Yeah, I mean, we think of we think of our approach to the world as being recognizing, somehow we reach out from our minds to, there's a cup. You know, where are my keys? Oh, there they are. I'm getting the world. I want to reach out almost like a hand to my eyes and ears. Where is what I'm looking for? But the world comes to get you. That girl hadn't got any interest, well, I don't know, hadn't got any interest in me and Francisco. She was just going from one place to another, but she appeared very rapidly in our minds, directly. And we were talking to each other about something we were quite interested in, but she came to get us. You see what I mean?
You wish.
I knew I should have gone down. Some things attract your attention.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them you can see why we're set up to have that get our attention. Like a sudden noise, a sudden movement in a place where
your babies cry.
Yeah, babies crying and so on.
Or I can give an example, because I think about this, I've been trying to explain it to myself for years. where I work, there's a bunch of mailboxes, you know, I mean, cubby holes, you know, where you place the mail. And so there's about 20 of them, maybe. And one of them is mine. Well, mine is the one that grabs my attention. Right? That's the one I see, because I'm looking to see if there's mail in it. And the others exist in a much less interesting way for me.
Unless they look like they've got more interesting posts than you.
Yes, or more. Yes.
I think there's this very subtle problem that comes up in this kind of bringing into awareness your, I'll say pre-reflective, because that's probably the more comfortable term for myself. But we're all, if we give it attention, we see that there are all these phenomena that are contributing to our lived experience. The pressure of the seat on our butt on the seat, the temperature in the room, the quality of light. And yet there's always this difficulty that when that moves from being pre-reflective to being something we actually reflect upon or direct our attention to, is it the same phenomena it was in the pre-conscious or the subconscious moment? Is that clear?
Yes, it's clear. That is really the big question. That I have no answer. In fact, I have no answer. I just think that there are different ways for this pre-reflective to become more or less. This pre-reflective can be more or less transformed, depending on the ways we reflect him, we access him. We can be trained to access it with more subtle and respectful, more or less subtle and respectful gestures. Or just, you can just completely ignore it, or access it, and in the same time transform it very much, and access it more precautionously and if we are trained. But we have the challenge is to identify these different levels of accessing the pre-reflective, and I don't want to say that
just the question is only if it is different, if it may be different,
maybe,
and it appears that it may be different because the act of attention itself is the transformative element.
Yeah.
Or the potentially transformative, in the, you know, even in the physical sense, if the observation of anything seems to transform what's being observed. So I guess for me, that's all I was saying is there's this difficulty, it seems, with making this scientific, because if everything that is pre-reflective gets transformed in the attention to it, then it seems to me you are lost in
this layer after layer
of changing what you are aware of in your awareness.
But if we know exactly more how it transforms, it changes the problem.
Can I bring back the question I asked you earlier? Because I think it's a very interesting test kits or private experiments. Do other people know about this movement of transplanters?
No, never heard about it.
It's a kind of development of change balance. The experiment says, and the results are, I think, astonishing. Two cards are laid on the table, two faces, and the subject is asked to choose which is the most attractive. Okay, chooses this one, say. This one is then handed to the subject, and they are then asked to reflect, introspect on their reasons for making that choice. But, in fact, they've been handed not the card, they chose the other one, because it's a contradiction. And so they get not they get the face they didn't choose. In 80% of the cases, they accept it as the card they chose, and then give their introspection, effective reasons, for having chosen that, referring to the colour of the woman's hair, or smile on her face, or a jewelry, and why this was the reason they preferred it to the other one. This is a clear example where we've scientifically can establish that they are giving reasons which cannot be the reasons they actually have.
Can you repeat that, just the last one?
They give reasons yeah. which cannot have been the real reasons for making the choice. And so it opens up the possibility that the methods which you're using for getting to the pre-reflective stages, which are responsible for, you know, first person experience, are actually not going to work. Every time it's going to be a reconstruction rather than a actual memory for what was being done. I mean, in the choice blindness case, the subject makes up a story about what could have been the reasons for the choice he has been told he made or he didn't make it, and then it assumes it's his own.
I would assume that in this experiment the cards are very similar, because if they were very different...
They're quite a lot different.
In fact,
how different?
Well, there's one card is a blonde woman and the other card is a dark-haired woman.
How many people notice that they haven't been given the right card? 20%.
But, you know, I don't think that's really a very difficult case, because you're asking people to explain their reasons for doing something. And that takes you into a whole different mode entirely. It has nothing to do with the immediate experience that you have. You're just asked to justify something. And yes, they come up with a justification. But, you know, it seems to me there's three levels. Really. There's a pre-reflective level, and then there's a reflective level, if you use that in a relatively narrow sense, to describe what you're talking about. Reflect on why you made the choice you did. But in between, there's the actual experience, which is available to consciousness, and in that sense, it's not pre-reflective. And that's the level you want to look at.
But Kaz's techniques get to it, because she's asking them retrospectively to...
She's not asking them for reasons. She's not asking them to explain. She's asking them, what was your experience?
Why couldn't that also be a reconstruction? I mean, remember...
It's possible it could be, but I'm just saying that the example you give doesn't really add any weight against it, because you've moved to a different level.
But I'm on pretty public record, I guess, as most of you know, of being fairly critical of Claire's method, and so I think it probably does not get to the pre-reflective experience that she gets to it. But what I think and what you think doesn't actually really matter in important ways, it seems to me. Because I think she's trying to do things which are very central to the interests of this group. So, for example, she is trying to figure out whether there is something about the experience right before an epileptic seizure that an epileptic person could actually learn to recognize. Now, I'm critical of how she goes about doing that. I would do it differently if I were doing it. Whether my method would be better than hers, I think, is the proper... a proper topic of conversation for this group, that we should try to figure that out. But if her method or my method or somebody else's better method can answer that question, then it, in some important ways, it doesn't much matter whether that epileptic experience is the same as that other epileptic experience, as long as going through the process helps that guy get over his seizures and that guy get over his seizures as well. So it's not a question that can be answered in a sort of a yes-no manner. It's a matter of, in this particular kind of a situation, does it provide an important scientific result, which I think an epileptic who could say, well, I can stop my seizures if I can recognize this in myself. Even if his report might be, well, before a seizure comes on, I don't have any idea about seizures. I sense a sweetness in the left hand side of my visual field, whatever the hell that means.
And somebody else says, some other epileptic says, and just before I get a seizure, I sense a sweetness in the left-hand side of my visual field. And some other epileptic says the same thing. And so we can train those people to pay attention to this sweetness in the left-hand side of their visual field. And if they do so, and all of them say, well, if I knew that, now that I know that, I can put my fingertips together and my seizure goes away. And if that works for them, I'm saying fine. Now, it could very well be that the sweetness in the left-hand side of the visual field of this guy is much different from that guy, and it's much different from that guy, and in a way it doesn't matter. But I think it's actually more likely that it does, that it's similar than it is that it's different. But it doesn't matter really fundamentally. Mm. But it seems to me that it's the proper goal of this group to try to determine what would be the best method to go about finding this phenomenon. Under what circumstances does this method work or that method work?
Mm. I think I think you're absolutely right about that. But just as a side to it, in terms of, we're thinking about first-person access to these signs of coming up epileptic fit. What's very interesting is the new work people know that dogs can detect a coming on of an epileptic fit. And now increasingly epileptics are being given dogs which can give them a warning, the subject that he or she's going to have the fit. The dog is presumably not using, it's using third person method, it must.
It's using.
Can I just have an interesting thought? The example you're giving might be an interesting test for the accuracy of your approach, because suppose you have these two cards, right? You hand this person the card 80% of the time, they don't realize it's been switched. And then you say, now I want you to go back very carefully and give me all of the reasons that you chose this card. And maybe you have the other one there too. In at least a certain percentage of cases, you would expect that if they really began to reconstruct the actual experience that led them to choose one card, at a certain point they would say, wait a minute, this isn't the card I chose. Don't you think?
I don't think so. I think that they would never know the card that they didn't choose. But that doesn't matter either, because it's a well-known fact for 50 years, I think, in psychology, that people don't know what causes them to do things. And they make up all kinds of things to justify causation.
Yes, but
if we can trick them, which I think we certainly can, we can get them to, in quite unusual situations, we can trick people to try to make causes that, to give explanations for things that don't actually matter. So the bottom line there is, you shouldn't ask people to give explanations about the causations of their behavior, because they can't do it.
Could I ask whether you could give us an example from your own work of somebody who you've worked with who can tell you about how something which had been pre-reflective became something they could reflect on?
Yes. For example, the first exercise we gave to our students, the students to whom we teach these methods. The task consists in memorizing a matrix of 9 numbers, and the students. It takes them 10 seconds or 30 seconds to memorize. And then we ask them to recite the numbers, and okay, you perform the task, it's okay. And then we make them aware with our questioning of the way they proceeded in memorizing the task. And there are a lot of pre-reflective operation, especially about the way they construct an internal image of the matrix. There were some of them were not even aware that they had. They were constructed an internal image. In fact, it's the most used strategy is to construct an internal image of the matrix. And in fact, all of them construct it in a specific way. Some of them begin by folding the cases from left to right on this one, and then this one, and then this one, and they are helped with sometimes helped they help themselves with internal voice repeating the numbers, or some of them are precise. We can see it when they are memorizing. They put the numbers, but they are not even aware that they make these gestures. And in fact, it corresponds to an internal gestures that puts the numbers in an internal imaging matrix image from which they are not even aware. And this is the first one, but I gave some examples of tasks as climbing a nice face, writing a paper, writing a poem, a letter. In fact, we are so we focus so much on the result, on the content, and we are not aware at all of the, for example, the internal images. Internal dialogues we use to do that. Mm. And these particular dimensions of emergence of the idea we want to express, which is transmodal, which is not specifically visual, nor auditive, nor tactile, but something is emerging. And when an idea, for example, when we're writing, we write an article, and an idea emerges. So, this level may last a long time before taking a specific sensorial form. We just feel that something is emerging, and it transforms it, and then it takes a specific form suddenly or more progressively, and this level usually is not conscious at all, except if we have turned our attention towards it, and so we manage with it, we work with this level, but usually we work with it very very well, but unconsciously. Is that more clear?
I just wanted to. One of the things that interests me about this work that you're reporting on is how it actually relates to consciousness. You just said this is not conscious, this process is not conscious. But I just wanted to ask you, do you really mean that? I mean, I know it's not. It's not fully conscious. Well, I think you think that. But is it in some way, do you believe, as I think I do, that it's somehow in one's consciousness, in that you can retrieve it and acknowledge it as in some way in the texture of your consciousness, even though it's not... it's not conscious in the sense of being at the pinnacle of your consciousness. I don't know if that makes sense. I find it very difficult to describe this very clearly. But somehow I feel that the way we talk about, the way many of us talk about consciousness has this problem of being too simplified.
Yeah.
And a lot of what you're doing is...
It's very, a very difficult question. For me, I don't I don't see, I don't think that this pre-reflective part is somewhere in a location of a consciousness, somewhere. It's not, it's a dynamic process. So it's different. But it's, I think I have no answer. I've never read a good answer to that question. And I'm sorry, but I have none.
Can I have a crack at answering that question or opening a question even further?
And the Pandora's box.
Well, and it comes back to John's question as well. That if a beef had come right before the matrix had been memorized, it's possible that the person would have recorded, well, I had an image of an image of a matrix. And then, but if the beef didn't come, then that would have passed and entirely unnoticed. And so when you ask the person, well, how did you get that? They say, I don't know. So now the question is, well, would you call that pre-reflexive? And now I think we need to have two different categories. There's a pre-reflective. We need to have two different categories here. One which would be that was never in consciousness and therefore never remembered. And another that was in direct awareness but was forgotten because it was so fleeting. And I don't know that your work distinguishes between those two realms, basically. And I think they're quite different realms, because one is a retrospectively forgotten and the other is never was there. So they're quite dramatically different, it seems to me.
Let me for example, if when someone's riding a bicycle, you give them a beep and ask them how they were balancing at that point. They couldn't give an answer. There is no answer in consciousness.
Right.
If when someone's driving a car, you ask them why they are taking the left turn, they probably can, with the beep, give the answer, although asking at the end of the journey if they remember which turns they took, they couldn't at all. That would have been lost. There was something in consciousness.
Well, no, I don't think that's actually true. But I have many beeps from people who are driving, and they have no consciousness at all of their driving, and as they report under my most careful questioning. And obviously, they're driving skillfully, they're making turns, they're not running into people. But very many beeps, they're listening to the conversation that they were having, and not with no awareness of their consciousness.
Well, we should break in just a couple more questions.
I wanted to sort of spring off of Wendell's question, because he was asking, in the process of representing the micro gestures, do you transform them in a way that makes them different from what you thought you were studying? And that sort of caused me to think about the process by which these micro gestures are being looked at, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which have a whole series of things where first you discriminate them from the background, then you can try to conceive what's being discriminated, then you try to conceptualize what you just conceived, then you try to represent what you just conceptualized, then you try to articulate that representation, and finally you figure out how to express it linguistically or non-verbally, right? So you have this whole sequence of micro-processes to deal with the recognition of the micro-gesture. So it seems to me that that's equally applicable to the recognition of states. And in fact, the example you gave about the epileptic possibilities, it's really not about micro gestures, it's about states, right? It's about representing impending states as opposed to processes by which I'm doing a conscious act. So that sort of leads to my question, which is, in the tradition of first-person research, which is, mystical reports, is a lot of work has been done in identifying states of consciousness, extremely subtle states. And in doing that, there are two aspects that I wanted to point out. The first one is that the vocabulary that's generally available is inadequate for expressing. The vocabulary is inadequate because our vocabulary typically comes from our sensory phenomenal experience. And so you can apply that to some extent, but at a certain point, the mental experience is so subtle that those sensory references are irrelevant. So therefore, many mystical systems have developed their own terminologies for all these different states. Do you think that in the process of your becoming increasingly subtle, that will be required, that you will run out of the ability to articulate, you know, linguistically what's being discriminated? That's my first question. My second question is I'll hold the second question.
Yes. Is your question, do we need to create new words?
Right. As other mystical... Yeah.
Yes, we need, if you want to explore these levels of consciousness, especially in this dynamic approach, we have no words for the lower levels. No words. We have to create them. And I think a word doesn't, in my opinion, doesn't express anything. It's just, as Jan Biener describes it very well, it's just a pointer. You say, oh yes, that, we are going to call it Schmilblick, or I never... but we have to... We need pointers on these levels, these... all these subtleties, and I think in other traditions, in Indian philosophy, for example, there are a lot of words for identifying these levels of consciousness and all these dimensions that for which we have none.
So some of these terms that you would develop. Or that are already developed that we could adopt if we understood what they meant.
Can I have a different answer to that question? Could I provide a different answer to that question? Because I think the answer might be to subtract terms rather than add them.
Mm-hmm.
And to subtract terms, to take away terms. So I don't need. I don't think that Claire's pre-epileptic study needs any knowledge at all of a state that might occur before a epileptic seizure. You don't need any knowledge of that state at all. What you need is a recognition of what the experience that you happen to be having right before you have a seizure.
What's in the word?
It doesn't have anything to do with the existence or the non-existence of the state. It is the existence of the experience. Before the event occurs.
The experience of the state.
No. The experience, whatever it is.
The experience is the state.
No. The experience is the experience. And if that experience is useful to you, you don't need to know whether this is a state. The problem with states is I think they're fuzzy categories and they have no beginnings and no endings and they gradually occur.
So that's very pragmatic. If you wanted to sort of understand it more structurally, you might have to get beyond the pragmatic aspects of what prevents me from having
may I say something? Yes. but why are we here? If we have just a pragmatic goal, therapeutic or if our goal is just pragmatic to transform experience as to transform epileptic experience. I agree with you that we don't need terms. We don't need to identify specific states. We don't need to make a science of consciousness. It's a different goal. Est-ce que c'est pas clair ce que je dis?
I think so.
For me, it's a real question. Why do I... is it really important to to prove that that we access something to. Est-ce que c'est vraiment important de travailler sur les méthodes d'accès à la conscience, d'essayer de montrer à la communauté scientifique que ces méthodes sont sont fiables, reliable methods and reliable results? What's the goal? In fact, personally, I don't care. I don't care. But my goal is to, because I think that the scientific community has un grand poids.
A great weight.
They have much influence in the long term of our lives, of the on the way we live, and
great influence.
Yeah. And I try to just to call their attention on this level of consciousness. But the goal is to transform the experience. For me, the main goal is to become able to transform our experience, epileptic experience, or our experience as living humans. And the scientific is just a way, un détour.
Yes.
Let me just say that it's almost 12:30, which is lunchtime. Maybe what we could do is if people do want to have lunch, I suppose, is go up there and maybe we can even just make one big table in the dining room and continue the conversation there over lunch.
Gee, that was just wonderful there. That was so exciting.
Yeah.
Can I get a copy of it? For the paper?
Yes, it's the one for the PowerPoint.
Oh, but you're reading the paper.
This one, yes, that's one.
Oh, wow.